Hello, good morning, good afternoon, and good night to all those who end up joining me in these dark woods for this, The Great Journey Podcast, and I'm your trail guide, Luke Keesh. Here we go down the strange, bizarre, and spooky paths and trails and the unusual happenings and people which fill our world. So, would you kindly grab your thermoses and fill them up, and we'll head out for this week's bonus trail of a collection of mythological minutes from the first half of Season 1. Before we can head out, we have to pay the toll for the Undertaker's fee, and this trail's fee is two. The first one is, Greek mythology can be summed up in one sentence. Unfortunately, Zeus was feeling horny. And the second is, I have an unhealthy sexual attraction towards figures in Greek mythology ever since I laid my eyes on Medusa. I've been rock hard ever since. Now, for this trail, it won't be a normal trail, since I just basically put together all the collections of mythological minutes that we had for the first part of Season 1 as a bonus, and I will be adding in the Hades and Persephone story from the Winter Solstice and Yule Trail. And instead of a mythological minute for this trail, instead I will do a mythological minute on the Aesop Fable. So, let's get into the Collection of Mythological Minutes, Volume 1. So, the mythological creature from the first episode was the Moon Urvegi. I'll just spell it out, just so if anybody wants to look it up on their own. MOONGER space VEGGEY. They're from Celtic lore and the Manx people. The name came from the Manx term describing little people or fays. And the description for these are 2 to 3 feet high, wearing red caps, green jackets, and they look kind of like humans. They're often seen on horseback and with little hounds, which is hilarious, each in a different color of the rainbow. And these guys aren't like the Disney type of fairies. These are mischievous, spiteful little beings, more akin to the Grimm fairy tale type of thing, and can only be seen by people of their choosing. But mostly they are on the Isle of Man or the ancient Tumoli region in Wales, and entrap musicians with their songs and try to steal them away. Or women and children have also been encountered in stories being taken from these creatures as well. And then generally they try to bring misfortune to the people that they encounter, or if you're displeasing them, they'll also try to bring misfortune upon you as well. Few cases see them curing people of disease and saving them from the same misfortune that they so cause. But more of the cases land on the misfortune type of thing than being mischievous little creatures. So tips to keep them away or not to please them. To keep them away would be iron or salt. All fae creatures seem to hate these objects, and basically to not displease them, the Manx women would not spin on Saturdays because they didn't like it for some reason, and they would also, when they were baking bread of dough with butter in it, during the churning process, they would take a small piece of it and stick it on the walls and let the little creatures eat on it, and that would be what would please them and keep them from creating misfortune and harm to the people that lived in that town or household. And, well, I'm quite frankly happy I'm not a musician at this point, because I would not like to be taken by these little mischievous creatures, because I've heard bad stories about fae creatures, so. And the mythological creature from the second episode is the Yukamama. And here it is. And this week we have a South American creature from the Brazilian area, Peruvian Amazonian rainforest to be exact, and it's the Yukamama. And the Yukamama means mother of water. Yuka is water, mama, mother. And this comes from the Peruvian language. And then the Yukamama is believed to be the mother of all creatures of the water. And according to legend, the Yukamama, it could suck up any living creature within 100 steps of it. And it is said to be at least 120 to 160 feet in length. And then it has a 6-foot wide head. And it also, in some stories and accounts, has the ability to shoot an explosive jet of water and is able to topple trees with ease just as it moves around. The indigenous people of the area blow a conch horn before entering the water, as in they believe the creature would signify its presence if it hears the sound of the conch horn. Other ways to get rid of it, though, is either to detach its head or to pierce through its head with a spear or a gun type of object to shoot through the head, just as long as you hit the brain. And to be honest, I really wouldn't trust that conch shell too much, being as it's just a horn, and I don't think a snake would really give its presence away if it heard that. It would just wait and then eat you. But in modern times, at least, there was a black boa documented to be 130 feet long with a head 6 feet wide. So this creature, the Yukamama, seems to have slithered out of history and into modern times. But again, these people could have just seen in the past a really big snake that lived in the past and just kind of adopted a mythology surrounding the creature. Most likely that is the case to all other mythological creatures. They typically come from this type of arrangement where they come from a natural creature and just given supernatural properties for the indigenous people to just kind of develop a mythology around them to explain it. So, and with that, that's the end of the mythological minute. And the next mythological minute comes from our Halloween episode on Samhain, and it is the Changeling. It is tied in to the Fae, as we discussed earlier, so I decided to continue with the Irish mythology theme for this episode. And this is sometimes subcategorized as the She, but in almost all accounts is given the name Changeling. And if it sounds familiar, it's because it's a classic creature in mythology and probably familiar to most people. If you're familiar with a show called Supernatural, it is featured on episode 2, season 3, where they encounter a group of changelings. But that is far from what the mythology actually is. These creatures aren't exactly harmful, but are extremely terrifying from the viewpoint of a parent. A changeling is an ill-tempered and look wizened and wrinkled beyond their years, and are supposed to resemble babies or young children. They grow and develop a lot quicker than humans, though. The babies, within a few weeks, have a full set of teeth, and their legs and arms will be very bony and thin. When a changeling is found, it's usually swapped for a baby. And sometimes the human baby is taken, but only a log or a bundle of sticks is left in place, and they are enchanted. The Fae parents usually do this, and there are a lot of reasons on why they do this. The Fae are known to envy human babies' happiness, healthiness, the sturdy bodies they come with, or that the baby isn't loved enough by the parents, or sometimes just out of spite or of malice. And then there are some accounts to say that they want to breed with the humans to strengthen the bloodlines so that they don't have such weak and frail bodies. The people of the Fae particularly like to take certain types of people. And when regards to children or the young, they might take a handsome boy to later become a lover of a female Fae, or a healthy baby, since most of the time Fae children that are born of Fae are born deformed, if at all, because most times the pregnancies are not carried to full term in the mythologies. But when an adult is swapped out for a changeling, it is usually for a midwife or a new mother, since they are favored by the Fae Queen to be servants or to tend to Fae children, since they are easily able to attend to children being new mothers. And also, families that have had children swapped with changelings will have misfortune or ill luck, since it is said that the changeling will drain the parents or family that it's with of its luck and good fortune. Some stories have the children swapped with the changeling return home after several years and are seen as changed by being in the Fae realm. And those changes could include a mastery of certain knowledge, mainly herbs, or magical knowledge or other gifts, as certain people dubbed them. But mainly they were just looked as different than normal humans after coming back. Some ways to keep them away from you or your children was fire. Fae of this kind feared fire and feared the repercussions of being burnt. And as said earlier in some stories, the Fae have the power of breathing fire, but with the changeling specific type of Fae creature, they are very vulnerable to fire and being burnt. They can't touch iron, so in the mythologies and folklore, people would put iron on their cribs or make iron completely out of the cribs, or at least cover certain parts of the crib in iron, so that when the Fae tried to come over and swap the children, they couldn't actually touch the crib to grab the children. And in some accounts, which aren't, I don't know how they thought this was a good idea, but they would tie strings of iron chains around the baby's necks at night to ensure that they couldn't be touched at all by the Fae. Not really a good idea, chain around baby's neck. Doesn't sound really good at all. But if your child is taken by the Fae, you shouldn't mistreat the changeling that is left or abandon it, since the Fae were said to do worse to your child if you did that to theirs. If you loved and cared for the changeling, though, there would be a possibility that you could get your child back. Some ways to get your child back from the Fae are several times of the year when the Fae leave their home, you can steal back your child. And to do that, you needed certain specific rites and rituals that could be performed by a druid priest and get them back. And then the last way to get them back particularly was to trick the changeling itself. And what the folklore says to do was to pretend to prepare an entire meal within an empty eggshell. This would cause the changeling to say one of these two things. Acorn before oak I knew, an egg before a hen. Never one's hen eggshell stew enough for harvest men? Or? Long have I lived, and much have I seen. I have seen the rawled forest burn down, and seven times grow up again. But never have I seen anyone brewing in an egg. And then the mother must threaten punishment for not being able to accomplish this task. And this will cause the fae to disappear and return your child later. And with that, I would like to read a little poem that usually is a focal point regarding the changeling folklore in Irish mythology. And pardon any stumbling in the poetry, it might not be as fluid. I just thought it was a nice little addition that I found to go along with the changeling, and it wasn't a long story, it was just kind of something short to read. So here we go. The summer sun was sinking with a mild light, calm and mellow, and shone on my little boy's bony cheeks and his loose locks of yellow. The robin was singing sweetly, and his song was sad and tender, and my little boy's eyes, as he heard the song, smiled with sweet, soft splendor. My little boy lay on my bosom, while his soul the song was quaffing. The joy of his soul had tinged his cheek, and his heart and his eye were laughing. I sat alone in my cottage, the midnight needle plying. I feared for my child, for the rush's light in the socket now was dying. There came a hand to my lonely latch, like the wind at midnight morning. I knew to pray, but rose again, for I heard my little boy groaning. I crossed my brow, I crossed my breast, but that night my child departed. They left a weakling in his stead. I am broken-hearted. Oh, it can't be my own sweet boy, for his eyes are dim and hollow. My little boy is gone to God, and his mother soon will follow. The drier for the dead will sung for me. The mass be charred sweetly. I will sleep with my little boy in the moonlight churchyard meetly. And that finishes up this mythological minute on changelings. And this is the mythological minute from Trail 4, the Uchalia. The mythological minute for this trail is the Uchalia, or Unchulia, from Native American mythology. This creature comes from the Sioux or the Lakota tribes, and they are located up in the Dakotas. This creature is said to have been first formless and shapeless. She had eyes of fire and a fanged mouth that was covered with a cloudy mass. As time went on, her form became one of a massive, scaly, long, serpentine body, whose scales were almost impenetrable. Her eyes burned with wrath and rage. Her claws were made of iron and a voice like thunder in a storm. She was known for having a slime that could rot flesh. If you saw the creature, you'll go blind, then you'll go insane, and then after 4 days, you die. It's able to crush people with just her pure size, and it is said to travel up rivers, polluting them and flooding the land so nothing would grow. She does have a weakness. 7 spots on her head, and behind it was a giant flashing crystal that functioned kind of like her heart, and was sought since it would grant the bearer immense strength. One account from the Lakota people was she was slain by a warrior after a weasel spirit told him that the scales of the beast were unbreakable, but if swallowed, you could cut through it and save anybody who was inside of her. And another story from the Sioux people tell of two twins that got an enchanted bow, and they went out and managed to hit all 7 spots on the back of her head. But before dying, she thrashed and writhed, causing so much damage it's still seen today as the Badlands of Nebraska and Dakota. And some believe that the rich amount of dinosaur bones could have been attributed to this mythological beast. And with that account, this ends the Mythological Minute for this trail. And this is the Mythological Minute for Trail 5, and it is the Nagi. So, this trail's Mythological Minute comes from Hindu and Buddhist mythology, and it can be traced to its origins in Jain or Jainism mythology, and it's the Naga or Nagi for plural, and that is a Sanskrit word for serpent or snake. They were said to be tribal spirits renowned for their beauty, wisdom, and magical powers. In one account, they encompass vast variety of serpent spirits. Others describe them as semi-divine beings, half-human, half-cobra. Buddhism mythology, they represent door guardians. In Tibetan mythology, they were minor deities. In other mythologies, they were guardians of Earth's treasures, which included minerals, metals, gemstones, petroleum, anything of value, ancient trees. In Jainism mythology, they are associated with fertility and healing. 527 named Nagis were worshipped in Kashmir, and 16th century historian found 700 places in Kashmir sacred to the named Nagis. They are said to live underwater in places like oceans, lakes, wells, springs, and rivers, and are mainly said to also appear underground in jewel palaces in places called Patla Loka, which is spelled Patla Loka. They were sent underground by Brahma. After they had become too populous and began to annihilate them, but when begged for mercy by the Nagi, he sent them underground and were commanded to bite those of true evil or those destined to die prematurely. They are said to have short tempers, and if angered, they will cause illness like skin lesions, leprosy, or mental illness and infectious diseases. There are two notable Nagis I want to discuss. The first, Shishra. She supports Vishnu as he lays on the cosmic ocean and creates the world's rest. 2. King Munchalanda, who sheltered the Buddha from rain for 7 days while he was in deep meditation. These stories and a couple others are in the 9th to 13th century Mon Khmer Buddhas. And that wraps up the Mythological Minute for this trail. This is the Mythological Minute for Trail 6, and it is the Owl Owl. So now, let's get into this trail's Mythological Minute. And it will be covering the Owl Owl, which is spelled A-O-A-O, and comes from Guarani region in South America. O can be translated for the Guarani word for clothes as well. But they got their name from the ao 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 they would howl as they would pursue their victims. One legend goes that the A'o is a cursed son of Ta'o and Kirna, two other Southern American mythology gods, and another goes, someone got cursed by a witch to become the first A'o. The first one is said to be extremely fertile in both legends, and every child that it has is cursed to look like it is, and because of this is given the Guarani fertility spirit role. And with such large numbers that they produced with this fertility, and with being seen in mountainous areas and forests, they were also given the title or distinction as Guardians of the Mountain. Now, what they look like. They were claimed to be giant bluish-green, furry type of humanoid sheep mixes, with massive fangs coming out of the top of their jaw. And they were supposedly, like stated earlier, half human, half creature, basically. And for what they eat is human. If you became their next meal, they would chase you no matter the distance or the terrain. But if you could find a palm tree and climb up it, you could be safe, since the palm tree seemed to have a repellent quality to them, or was in some cases in South American mythology was sacred, so that repelled them through that action as well. But if it was a small palm tree, the A'o would try to dig up the roots of the tree and topple over to get to you. But if you couldn't make it up the tree, you were its dinner and it ate you all and your clothes. And that is also one of the reasons why it got the name A'o, for the clothes eating aspect of it. And that wraps up the mythological minute for this trail with the A'o A'o from South American mythology. Next is from the mythological minute on trail 7 on the Luan bird. So, this week's mythological minute is in China, and it is the Luan bird, L-U-A-N, or the Linanio, L-U-A-N-N-I-A-O. This bird is said to live 820 li from the beginning of the second guideway through the western mountains of the Lady's Bed Mountain, and presides over the northern slope. The Luan was regarded only second to the Fung Hong bird among the divine birds, and is often confused with it as well. The bird is born of the sperm of a red god, and has the form of a pheasant or chicken with a very large tail plume, primarily colored red with five colored markings on it. It is said to wear a shield as a hat and have a dead crimson snake on its chest, and appears to stomp or tread on snakes as well. Luan is also musical. They've been seen to sing spontaneously in parallel with the spontaneous dancing of the Fungguang bird. It sings in five standard pitches and will appear if it hears hymns to rulers are sung. People often saw them as omens of peace in the world when seen. Now a portion from the Warring States period on the Luan. Luan was presented as tribute by the Northwestern tribes to King Xing of Zhou, for submission to his virtuous rule, as a signifying of its great peace he brought. And a second little insert from where they are found, and this comes from the Classic of Mountains and Sea, Book 11, The Classic Regions Within the Seas, the West. To the west of the open bright, there are the divine Feng bird and the Luan bird, which wear snakes on their head and tread snakes underfoot, and on their breast these birds wear a scarlet snake. North of the open bright, there are the look flesh creatures, pearl tree, the patterned jade tree, the sacred tree, the never die tree, and also the Fung and Long bird wearing shields on their head. And that finishes up this week's Mythological Minute. Now, this is the Mythological Minute for Trail 8, the Rugaroo. So, this week's Mythological Minute is in Louisiana with the Rugaroo. Or, it could be commonly called the Loup-garou. Both stem back to French culture of the Muratises or the Franconian people or culture. And it traveled through to the Cajun cultures of the Caribbean islands and in the south of Louisiana while it was still under French control. The Rougarou's name, but more specifically the Loup-garou, because Rougarou is more of a corruptization of the Loup-garou, and the Loup means wolf and Garou means man that transforms into animals. The Rougarou is said to prowl the swamps and bayous around Arcadia and New Orleans. The Rougarou is a type of lycanthrope creature which walks upright and looks similar to a wolf-human hybrid type of creature. And at first, the legends were you were a genetic Rougarou, like you were born this way, you have a clan, a family that were all the same. And as time went on, the story changed and you were more turned into a Rougarou rather than you are a Rougarou. One states that you could be bitten, turned into a Rougarou, and it could either be permanent or it could be a phasal thing where if you don't eat human flesh, you might not transform into a Rougarou, or you might just be periodically a Rougarou depending on the moon cycles. Then you could also have a legend that also pertains to if you're cursed by a witch, you could either be a Rougarou for 101 days, or if you're bitten, you could be a Rougarou for 101 days until the curse wears off from the original Rougarou that bit you, and it transfers to somebody else. In all cases, though, the Rougarou can control the shape-shifting abilities that it has after it eats human flesh, and or start sucking blood of humans specifically, because it can feed off of animals, humans, and anything with meat and blood. Most stories of the Rougarou are of it scaring or attacking people who are either bad, breaking rules, or doing something disobedient. A lot of times you would see this story popped up to scare children to be good and kind of stuff like that. One really good story that I found about him was that they will hunt down and kill any Catholic who does not follow Lent. And specifically with French Catholics, they also have a specific belief to how you transform into a Rougarou, and that's if you don't adhere to the Lent practices for 7 years, you just straight up become a fucking Rougarou. Like, now you fucked up, bitch. Go eat shit now. But to deal with a Rougarou, it's kind of tough. There's a couple main things you can do. You can fight it with fire. Some say if you cut it and throw salt and pepper in its salt for some reason, you could leave it out and it dies of exposure. Don't know really how that one works. Other stories is decapitation, just straight like Supernatural and the vampires just lop off its head. And others say even if you decapitate its head, you still gotta cut up the rest of its body in little dice cubes and then mutilate it. Doesn't really give you specifics on how to mutilate it, so go have fun with that one. And that's how you keep a Rougarou dead, because it says even if you decapitate it, in some cases it can regenerate together, which that's just fucking scary. And now I want to do a little story of a specific Rougarou story I found. And it goes, an old woman made a pact with the devil. For what she wanted, we don't know. She had to pay it, though, with large quantities of warm blood. To collect, the devil turned her into a Rougarou. During the day, she would walk as a human and scavenge like a vulture. And at night, she would shapeshift and bolt through the bogs and woodlands, attacking people and animals to get the blood she needed. But one night, she was injured and forced back to human form. And still while injured, the mob that tracked her down found her in her weakened state, beheaded her, killing the Ruguru. And that finishes up this week's Mythological Minute with the Ruguru. This is the Mythological Minute for Trail 9, the Tsukeya. Into this Mythological Minute for this trail, which is the Tsukeya. This is from Dominican Republic, Trinidadian, Guadalupean, Haitian, and Caribbean folklore. And particularly in Caribbean folklore, it is called the Ulhigui, which is O-L-E. H-I-G-U-E, and in the Bahamas, it is simply referred to as hag. And the Tsukeya is also said to have been a precursor for the Ruguru from last week's Mythological Minute. This creature is said to come from fey legends from France and England, then brought over to meld with new cultures in the Caribbean and island settings. Which basically put this creature into the category of vampire or succubi or incubi, because it is said to be a shape-shifting, blood-sucking hag. In the folklore, Tsukeya is a reclusive old woman who practices obe and guides those in spiritual matters, and this is done in the day. But at night, she strips off her meat suit and hides it in a mortar. This is to release her true form, which is a fireball which flies through the sky and finds its victims. Once they find a victim, it can get through any small crack of a house, even through a keyhole if needed. And while you sleep, it will suck out your blood from either your arms or your legs, leaving a blue-black mark behind where it bit. If they suck too much blood, though, and you die, you might become a Tsukeya. And if not, the creature will just take your skin and use it. If they just end up collecting blood from you, though, they end up using this in black magic. To give this to a demon which is found in a silk cotton tree. It is not said, though, what form this black magic will take. Now, though, when you need to deal with these creatures, there's a couple ways you can. They are very similar to fey, where if you throw rice or grains in front of them or around your house to protect yourself from having them enter, they are forced to count every single individual grain till they have them all. Then, if you're lucky enough and you find her mortar where she hid her skin, all you have to do is dose it with coarse salt and grind it into her skin, and this makes it unwearable to her and she dies of exposure. And also, this creature is said to still be alive and its skin is very valuable, particularly to those who practice black magic. And with that, that ends the Mythological Minute. Now for the Mythological Minute from Trail 10 and the first of the Christmas episodes, and this one was on Greya and her family. Now for the Mythological Minute. And we're going to stay in the Icelandic, Norse, and Germanic mythology with a troll clan of Greya, and sometimes is a giantess clan, but in both times it is around a central figure of Greya. And they lived in what was described as a lava fortress of Deningenberg, or Deningengug, in the Mesitane area of northern Iceland. She is said to have hooves and have small horns on her head with a very large and warty nose. She used to also possess multiple heads, but is now commonly depicted with only one. She also possessed 13 to 15 tails, and on each she had about 100 sacks, all meant for children, which she abducted. The reason she abducted children was because she had an irresistible taste and appetite for the flesh of naughty children. And during this time of year, she had no short supply, since she collected whispers about naughty children throughout the year, and during December she descended and set out to collect naughty children to cook up in a winter stew. And she also had a few mythological companions. The first one was something called the Gola Kudnuni, the Yule Cat, an enormous black cat who had an appetite for children, but didn't seek out just naughty children. This cat sought out and preyed on children who didn't get new clothes for Christmas. Then the second companion she had was her husband, which she had multiple before him, but whenever she tired of one of her husbands, she just killed them. And her current husband is Leopoldi, who is described as disabled and lazy, being limp in his legs. With these husbands of hers, she had about 13 kids, which are referred to as the Yule Lads, or Julgen Snuva, who pulled pranks and scared people from December 12th to December 25th. And I won't read their original names since I've already tried a couple pronunciations throughout this trail already. And, well, they're pretty difficult in and of themselves since I can't really speak English already good. So we'll just stick with the Englandizationed names that they have. And some of them might seem out of place and they're really on the nose. So if you are interested in them, just look them up later as the Yule Lads. And in some accounts, they specifically showed up on a day of December and stayed there until the 25th. And in some accounts, they would show up on that specific day and then leave. So, the first Yule Lad is Sheep Kutkod. He arrives on December 12th and is said to be deformed from the knees down, having wood pegs and not being able to bend from the knees. He would come and harass and scare sheep. And since the sheep were stored underground, you could hear the cries of the sheep throughout the house when he came. Then the second Yule Lad is Gully Gwark. He came on December 13th. He waited for people to sleep, and then he would steal their milk by drinking it straight from the cow's udders or stealing it from any that has been stored in the house. And since cream is used in multiple Yule recipes, it was an important ingredient during this time of year. Then the third Yule Lad, Stubby. He came on December 14th, and he was the shortest of the Yule Lads. He came and stole the house pans, which were still covered with crumbs from Yule dishes. Then the fourth Yule Lad is Spoon Licker, and he showed up on the 15th of December. He was also considered to be deformed because of how skinny he was, where you could almost see his bones. And like his name, he would come and steal spoons, still that had food on them, and lick them clean. Next is Pot Licker, or Pot Scraper Yule Lad, who came on December 16th, and much like his brother, he seeked out pots with food and meat left in them, and would eat any leftovers that he could find. Then the creepy brother, Bowl Licker, of the Yule Lads, showed up on December 17th. He would stay under kids' beds and wait for them to finish their nighttime soups or nighttime pudding. And when the bowls were placed on the floor, the Yule Lad would eat anything left in the bowl. Then Door Slammer Yule Lad showed up on December 18th. He would simply run through the town and slam people's doors that weren't secured shut. Then you have Skrig Gobbler, and he came on December 18th, and he only stole Skryr, which is S-K-Y-R, which was a type of cream found in a lot of Yule dishes, and he only stole the specific type of dish. Then you have the Sausage Snatcher, and he came on the 20th of December. And he would hide in the rafters waiting for a specific Icelandic smoked sausage to be made, which was called Bjugu, B-J-U-G-U. And then, when it was made and stored away, he would steal it. Then you had the Window Peeper, and was said to be the biggest of the Yule Lads. He showed up on December 21st, and he only wandered around and scared children that were staring out into the darkness of the night. Then you had Door Sniffer of the Yule Lads. He came on December 22nd, and he had the biggest nose of the Yule Lads, which he used to locate his favorite meal, which was called leaf bread. And once found, he would snatch up any he could grab. Then you had Meat Hook Yule Lad, and he would be around on the 23rd of December. And he was known to hide somewhere in the kitchen or close by and wait till the family would be asleep and steal any meat laying out with his massive meat hook, which gave him his name. Then the last Yule Lad, the Candle Stealer, who showed up on the 24th of December, and he stole candles, most of the time lit ones. And he stole them not for the flame, but he stole them so he could eat the tallows that the candles were made from. Then, on December 25th, Grella would descend to gather up any naughty children for her feast, and return to her home until next Yule. And that is the end of the mythological minute for this trail. And this story isn't a mythological minute, but comes from Trail 10 from the first part of the Christmas episodes, and is a story on Hades and Persephone, and still falls into the realm of mythology, and thought I would add it in here since it is short. So, one day Hades, the god of the underworld, saw Persephone, the goddess of vegetation and grain, with her mother Demeter, the goddess of nature, while on a walk in a garden on Earth. Hades saw Persephone from the underworld and instantly fell in love with her. So Hades decided to go to his brother Zeus, the king of the Olympian gods, for help in this matter. Zeus knew how much Demeter loved her daughter and would reject Hades. So, like most Greek heroes and in Zeus's many dalliances before, they decided to abduct Persephone and trick the goddess Demeter. So, later when Demeter and Persephone went to Earth, Demeter went over to see her bountiful harvest and inspect it and supervise it. And Persephone went to play with some of the sea nymphs, or called the Nereids and Naiads, that lived in freshwater lakes, springs, and rivers, and were the spirits of these waters. But before they arrived, Zeus told Gaia, the goddess of Earth, to plant a narcissus flower near where Persephone was about to be, but also out of range so the nymphs would not be able to follow when Persephone went to the flower. So, while playing, Persephone smelled the flower and followed its scent, dancing all the way, ignoring the nymphs' pleas to stay, and once she got to the flower, she plucked it from the ground. As she did, a huge chasm grew from the hole, bigger and bigger, and then out rode Hades in a chariot and grabbed the goddess and brought her back down to the underworld. After Persephone was taken, one of the Naiads, Cyane, was so grief-stricken that she melted into the river Cyane at that spot. Demeter heard the cries of the sea nymphs and rushed to where the kidnapping happened. But when she arrived at the location, nobody could tell her what happened to Persephone. And in anger, she cursed the nymphs into a hideous form, bearing the resemblance of a woman with feathers and scaly feet, later to be called the Sirens. So Demeter, in her grief, went to search for her daughter. She disguised herself as an old woman and went out and searched for 9 days and nights. During this time, no plant life on the earth would grow, and all started to die. But on the 10th day, Hecate, the goddess of magic and witchcraft, intervened and asked Helios, the god of the sun, for help. He told Demeter of what happened to her and of the treachery of Hades. So Demeter went to her brother Hades and begged him for Persephone back. But when he refused, she decided to go to Zeus for help. And Zeus couldn't tell her directly that he was involved with the kidnapping of Persephone. But instead, he sent his messenger, Hermes, who is the messenger of the gods. He went down to tell Hades to let Persephone go. But when Hades got there, he found something quite different from what he expected. Persephone was happy. Hades had built her gardens, treated her nicely, and gave her anything she asked for. And when Hermes asked Persephone to go, Hades became fearful that she might leave, so he gifted her 6 pomegranates, which she ended up eating. And this is important because in Greek custom, this meant that she had to return to Hades because it was believed that if one ate food given to them by their captor, that they were tied together, and the person who ate would have to return to the person that the food had been given from. And so Hermes returned to Zeus with this news. And to make both Hades and Demeter happy, Zeus decided that since Persephone ate the 6 pomegranate seeds, Persephone would spend half the year with Hades in the underworld, and then half the year with Demeter. And like I said, this is also what makes the winter seasons, is when Persephone is down in the underworld with Hades, and then the bountiful time of year when crops grow and everything else is when Persephone is with Demeter. And again, this also marks kind of the winter solstice time, because winter is this time as well when Persephone would be with Hades, and I couldn't find a Saturnalia tale, so I wanted to at least give a Greek or Roman tale that pertaining to the seasons, and this one is kind of perfect because you hear it a lot, and it's not kind of one of the classic ones, so there it is. Now this mythological minute comes from Trail 11, the Christmas Around the World episode, and is the second Christmas episode for this year, and it is over Shakti. Now for the mythological minute for this trail, and it is Shakti, a Jotun and goddess associated with bow hunting, skiing, snowshoes, winter, and mountains in Norse mythology. She is said to live in the highest reaches of the mountains where snow never melts. Here she travels on skis with her bow and arrow and hunts animals. Shakti is also the one who places a venomous snake above Loki's face to drip venom onto him while he is bound. She was also briefly married to Njord, a Vanir god of wind, of the sea, and its riches, and of wealth bestowal, but separated since Njord couldn't stand the cold and dreariness of the mountains, and Shakti couldn't stand the light and noise of the birds of the sea. Now I will tell the story of how Njord and Shakti got married, at least the version that I know, and I didn't look up anything for it, it's just off of my knowledge. Her father, Tarisi, was tricked by Loki and brought to Asgard, and the Aesir gods ended up killing him and putting him on the wall of the city. When Shakti heard of this, she got her weapons and all the weapons of war the Jotun had, and went to get her revenge for her father. But when she arrived, Odin was in a peaceful mood for some reason, and decided not to fight her, but offer her whatever she wanted. And it just so happened, she wanted Balder as a husband, since he was the most beautiful and most beloved of the gods. So she demanded that she was able to choose one of the gods as her husband, and for them to make her laugh. Odin agreed, but made a stipulation to where she had to pick a god only by seeing their ankles and calves. Shakti was okay with this because it was Balder. She thought he was the most beautiful god, and she could easily tell him by the ankles. So the Asgardian gods and all the gods present covered covered up everything, not mentioned on how they did this, possibly by barrel or by cloth, and they lined up. Then Shakti picked from the lineup, but unfortunate for her, there was another god who liked pedicures and knew the importance of lotion, and his ankles were as good as Baldur's. This was Nord, the Vanir god, and Shakti was a good sport and accepted him as her husband, and they were married by Odin on the spot. So they moved on to Shakti's second request of making her laugh. For this, Odin had just the thing. He ordered for a goat with a beard and Loki and a cord to be brought to them. Once they arrived, Odin tied one side of the cord to the goat's beard and then asked Loki to come to him. And since Loki was the start of all this, decided Loki needed some punishment to go along with all this. And Odin said that Loki will be playing tug of war with this goat. And Loki, well, he chuckled, saying, well, no problem, this goat isn't no problem, and tugged on the cord a little bit and gave it a jostle, and the goat pulled back. But Odin wasn't done speaking, and he told Loki to drop his pants. Loki confused, and Odin cleared it up for him by adding that the cord wasn't going to be in Loki's hands. They were going to tie it to his balls. So Odin tied the cord to Loki's balls, and when everything was ready, smacked the goat as hard as he could, and that fucking goat tore off, pulling Loki crotch first, full speed over the whole place. And when Loki started weeping and started chasing the goat to try to catch him, Shakti and all the gods present broke down laughing. A good, hearty, breath-grasping laugh. And then Loki caught the goat, brought him to Shakti, and asked for it all to end. She said okay, content with the amusement. And also, Odin, in such a good mood after that, decided to let Shakti take her father's body and bury it. So Shakti left for now, back to Jotunheim to bury her father. And now this is the most recent mythological minute, which was on Trail 12 and is on Ektomi. And so, for this week's mythological minute, I look at Ektomi from the Native American tribes of the Cheyenne, Lakota, Dakota, and Sac tribe. Traditionally, Ektomi is a trickster figure and god. His name literally means spider and is sometimes called Spider or Spider-Man in English. Also, he is generally depicted as a man but can also shape-shift, or at least change appearance depending on where he is and who he interacts with. One description goes, he wears brown deerskin leggings with long fringes and tiny beaded moccasins on his feet. His hair was long and black, parted in the middle and wrapped with red bands. His face was painted with red, yellow, and black rings around his eyes. He also had a deer skin jacket with bright colored beads. All of this is also similar to what a Lakota brave would be dressed as. Then, like said, Ektomi was a trickster, but not viewed as good or bad, and was typically companioned to Mesha or the Coyote, other Native American tricksters, and his powers included shape-shifting, using strings to control humans like puppets, the ability to create potions that change or mess with gods and change gods, the ability to control or gain control over people or gods to do what he wants. Then, in Lakota myth, there is a prophecy that Ektomi will spread his web all over the land. Some Native Americans believe this could be in relation to the telephone network system or the internet, the World Wide Web. Also in Lakota culture, he is the patron of new technology, stating he is the one that invented language and gave it to the people. Now to touch on his origins, which are varied with Ektomi. He is the son of Enron the Rock, a creator god, with the younger brother Aya, who is a storm monster and a powerful god. Then the story splits. One goes, Ektomi was Kasa, the god of wisdom in the beginning, but was stripped of his title and became Ektomi because of his troublemaking. The second is ectomy is the second manifestation or degradation of Kasa, which hatched from the cosmic egg laid by Wakanaya, the primordial thunderstorm. And that is his origins as ectomy, the trickster. Now for a short story of ectomy. One day, ectomy was walking on a breezy day and a hot day, so he decided to get out his handkerchiefs to wipe the sweat. But while pulling it out, the wind caught it and flew it up to the top of a large tree out of ectomy's reach. Then a young, strong man in a fine buckskin shirt, leggings, and a beautiful set of moccasins came to ectomy, and ectomy said, "Hello, little brother. You look nice today. I am sad." The young man asked ectomy why, and ectomy replied, "Because of my handkerchief. It blew into the tree, and my arms are not strong enough to reach it." So the young man said, "Maybe I can help." Ectomy said, "Yes, yes. You're young. You're strong. You could do it. But look at how you're dressed. Why get your nice clothes all dirty? Why not I wash them for you? Take them off and pile them up here, and go get my handkerchief for me, would you?" So the young man agrees, takes off his clothes and piles them by ectomy, and starts up to the tree. Part of the way up the tree, ectomy says, "Oh yes, these are nice, fine clothes." The young man asks quizzically, "What was that?" Ectomy replies, oh, nothing, my boy. Just be careful as you climb. You don't want to fall from there, do you?" Higher and higher the young man climbed, till having to round the tree to get even higher. And as the young man rounded the tree out of sight, ectomy yelled, "Why, thank you." The young man questioned, "What? I haven't gotten your handkerchief yet." Ectomy replied, "No, for the fine clothes." And he ends up taking the clothes and runs off. So, that ends the short story of ectomy and his small trickster stuff. And we probably will do an episode related to him with Native American cultures entirely, because there are multiple stories of ectomy, the trickster spider. But that ends our mythological minute. So, on this mythological minute for this trail, instead of doing a god or a creature, I will be doing 8 Aesop fable tales. And the first fable is Hercules and the Wagoner. A wagoner was once driving a heavy load along a very muddy way. At last he came to a part of the road where the wheels sank halfway into the mire, and the more the horses pulled, the deeper it sank. So the wagoner threw down his whip and knelt down and prayed to Hercules the Strong. "Oh, Hercules, help me in this my hour of distress," he quoth. But Hercules appeared to him and said, "Tut, man, don't sprawl there. Get up and put your shoulder to the wheel. The gods help them that help themselves." The next fable is The Goose with the Golden Eggs. One day, a countryman, going to the nest of his goose, found there an egg all yellow and glittering. When he took it up, it was as heavy as lead, and he was going to throw it away, because he thought a trick had been played upon him. But he took it home on a second thought, and soon found to his delight that it was an egg of pure gold. Every morning the same thing occurred, and he soon became rich by selling his eggs. As he grew rich, he grew greedy, and thinking to get at once all the gold the goose could give, he killed it and opened it to find nothing. Greed oft o'erreaches itself. The third fable is The Fox and the Lion. When first the fox saw the lion, he was terribly frightened and ran away, and hid himself in the wood. Next time, however, he came near the king of the beast, he stopped at a safe distance and watched him pass by. The third time they came near one another, the fox went straight up to the lion and passed the time of day with him, asking him how his family were, and when he should have the pleasure of seeing them again. Then, turning his tail, he parted from the lion without much ceremony. Familiarity breeds contentment. Next is the lion and the statue. A man and a lion were discussing the relative strength of men and lions in general. The man contended that he and his fellows were stronger than lions by reason of their greater intelligence. "Come now with me," he cried, "and I will soon prove that I am right." So he took him into the public gardens and showed him the statue of Hercules overcoming the lion and tearing his mouth in two. "That is all very well," said the lion, "but it proves nothing, for it was man who made the statue. We can easily represent things as we wish them to be." Fifth Aesop fable is the fisher. A fisher once took his bagpipes to the banks of a river and played upon them with the hopes of making fish rise, but never a one put his nose out of the water. So he cast his net into the river, soon drew it forth filled with fish. Then he took his bagpipes again, and as he played, the fish leapt up in the net. "Ah, you dance now when I play," he said. "Yes," said the old fish. "When you are in a man's power, you must do as he bids." So, the next Aesop fable is The Old Man and Death. An old laborer, bent doubled with age and toil, was gathering sticks in a forest. At last he grew too tired and hopeless that he threw down the bundle of sticks and cried out, "I cannot bear this life any longer. Ah, I wish death would only come and take me." As he spoke, Death, a grisly skeleton, appeared and said to him, "What wouldest thou, mortal? I heard thee call me." "Please, sir," replied the woodcutter, "would you kindly help me to lift this faggot of sticks onto my shoulders? We would often be sorry if our wishes were granted." And now for the seventh Aesop fable, The Fox and the Grapes. One hot summer's day, a fox was strolling through an orchard till he came upon a bunch of grapes just ripened on the vine, which had been trained over a lofty branch. "Just the thing to quench my thirst," quoth he. Drawing back a few paces, he took a run and then jumped and just missed the branch. Turning around again, with a 1, 2, 3, he jumped, but with no greater success. Again and again he tried after the tempting morsel, but at last he had to give it up and walk away, with his nose in the air saying, "I am sure they are sour." It is easy to despise what you cannot get. Now for the last Aesop fable, The Swallow and the Other Birds. It happened that a country man was sowing some hemp seeds into the field, where a swallow and some birds were hopping about, pecking their food. "Beware of that man," quoth the swallow. "Why, what is he doing?" said the others. "That is hemp seed he is sowing. Be careful to pick up every one of the seeds, or else you will repent it." The birds paid no heed to the swallow's words, and by the by, the hemp grew up and was made into a cord. And of that cord, nets were made, and many a bird that had despised the swallow's advance was caught in the nets made from that very hemp. "What did I tell you?" said the swallow. "Destroy the seed of evil, or it will grow up to your ruin." So, with the end of that fable, that will also end this week's trail over the collection of Mythological Minutes, Volume 1, from the first half of Season 1. I hope you like it. If you want to follow me, you can go to our Anchor page, which will be linked down below, and also our Facebook page will be linked down below for this podcast as well. All the show notes for the Mythological Minutes from previous trails will also be linked down below by trail number. And if you like it, please consider donating on the Anchor page. I am trying to get a Patreon page started here shortly. And, well, this has been the Great Journey Podcast, and I have been your trail guide, Luke Keesh, and I will be here stoking the fire until you guys join me again. So, goodbye.
I heard the thunder and lightning struck by your tower today. Down by the crew on the crash pool, catch out from the mighty and high. Ain't no one left for the good to go. No truth in a world full of lies. I run for and give and fed it throws from and stumble around. Gather all the greed to go back to their holy ground. Wash your hands of all the blood, beg, borrow and stole to keep a good man down. Shake the hands of Holy Ghost, dance along an ivory coast. Share your flesh with passing shadows on a bed of broken hopes. Be sure to breathe in deeply every medicine that your lungs can hold. Welcome all your bastard actions back home. Why do we cry, cry our eyes out in the low, lowly graves, mourning all the times we would've, could've, should've had our way. Hard-hearted heathens to their soul saving saints, spilling the blood in the same God's holy name. We were the heathens to their saints, spilling blood in the same God's holy name. Shake the hands of Holy Ghost, dance along an ivory coast. Share your flesh with passing shadows on a bed of broken hopes. Be sure to breathe in deeply every bit of sin that your lungs can.